Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Usual two guests today. In moments, Naomi Murakawa talks about the liberal contribution to the development of the carceral state, and then Amy Binder explores why so many graduates of elite colleges are going into consulting and finance. By coincidence, both guests came to me on the recommendation of my virtual colleague, Stephen Tellis, a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins. Murakawa's book is part of a series he edits, and Binder is one of the researchers in a project he's supervising for the Kauffman Foundation. First, Naomi Murakawa. She's an associate professor at the Center for African American Studies at Princeton. Her book, The First Civil Right, How Liberals Built Prison America, is just out from Oxford University Press. Naomi Murakawa. The title and subtitle of your book make for an interesting paradox, because The First Civil Right, the title, is a quote from Richard Nixon, but then your subtitle is How Liberals Built Prison America. And I know Gary Wills once said that Nixon was the last liberal, but I don't think that's exactly what you mean by this. This phase of the story begins in the Truman years, really?
Yes. The first civil right is the right to safety. And the phrase the first civil right was, as you say, made famous through the 1968 presidential campaign when Richard Nixon traveled the country promising to restore law and order to a country that he thought was overrun with urban uprisings, mass protests, hippies, and rising crime. And of course, the first civil right is...
Now, just a second. Can we separate those two things? Because on the one hand, we did have protests in the streets and urban riots. On the other hand, there was worry about street crime. Did those things get blended in the political imagination of the time, or were they separate?
I would say they were blended. They were deliberately blended as part of a political strategy to conflate Black civil rights with criminality. And this is what was so powerful and telling about Nixon's statement, the first civil right of every American is the right to be safe. Because when he said that in 1968, it was striking, of course, because this was not the first civil rights of the time. This was a moment following the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and the war and court expansion of rights of the accused. So when Nixon in 1968 stood up and said, the first civil right is the right to be safe, he was giving a racial message, which is implicitly the white right to safety comes first, and it cannot be threatened by these other special rights, rights of minorities, criminal rights, rights of prisoners. And that was the way he put the right.
This, of course, was a very conscious political strategy, although coded in its language.
Absolutely. So the reason I made the first civil right the title is that in some ways, beginning with that Nixon account, captures the conventional wisdom for how we understand mass incarceration in the United States. So the conventional explanation for why we have the world's largest prison system is that we have conservatives, in particular Republicans, who used crime politics to court white voters who are resentful about civil rights liberalization. This is the sort of conventional wisdom. And I chose The First Civil Right as the book's title because I wanted to begin with a really simple historical intervention. And that intervention is just to note that two decades before Nixon made the phrase the first civil right famous, two decades before that, liberal law and order campaigns pursued the right to safety as the first civil right, and they also called it a step towards racial equality. And the context I'm referencing is the 1947 report from Truman's Commission on Civil Rights. And the context for that commission was that at the end of World War II, it was politically scandalous and internationally embarrassing for the United States that there were white mobs and white police officers working together in the brutalizing and lynching of African Americans, often veterans in uniform in 1946. So from this moment, Truman's Committee on Civil Rights declared that the first civil right was the right to safety. And the way they defined it, this entailed right to safety from private and state violence, safety from violent white mobs, and safety from the so-called misbehavior of white cops, judges, and wardens. And it's from this moment through the present that I think we see the consistency of a particular law and order agenda, and that is an agenda to build a better carceral state, one that is layered with police professionalization, more procedures, more guidelines to minimize disparities in criminal sentencing. In short, the liberal law and order agenda is a project to build the bias out of the criminal justice system.
So what we needed was a fair criminal justice system, but there was no broader social critique than that.
Absolutely. It needed to be fair. And the way we would know it was fair is that it would be rule-based and rights-laden. It would have the language of Miranda rights, a full language of due process, ways to put forward administrative complaints for conditions of incarceration. And I think it's fair to say that in the policy battles, there are a number of policy planks that liberal Democrats lost. That is, they just lost certain fights, and that's how we got to where we are. But it's also fair to say that they did damage by winning certain things. And I think the most damaging thing that liberal law and order won is that they won an ideological fight that says the way we measure criminal justice is by evaluating the administrative quality by which individual is searched, arrested, warehoused, or put to death. And that is the wrong standard.
Yeah, the putting to death thing, as I was reading your book, I was thinking the way people obsess over the precise nature of how the death penalty is administered, and it just must be humanely administered. It's okay if you do it right, but the ethical questions, philosophical questions about the death penalty itself get effaced in that discourse.
That's exactly right. And what is so telling about liberal Democrats, especially those through the Clinton administration, is that they simultaneously claim to provide some basics for a fair death penalty while they escalated the number of crimes punishable by death. And it's so clear that these two things go hand in hand. Right? That in the logic of how we justify warehousing and killing, the liberal language of having a rights-laden process is that which simultaneously legitimizes more warehousing and more killing.
Now, let's go back to the 40s and 50s. The Myrtle report, Gunnar Myrtle's report, of course, was very important, very influential. How does that figure in your story?
I would say that that's the touchstone text of racial liberalism. The American Dilemma actually figures quite prominently in the 1947 Commission report on civil rights. It's remarkable that a lot of the lines from the American Dilemma are brought into the Commission report, but it's important to remember that Myrdal's understanding of prejudice was that it was something that existed in the heart of America, or really the heart of white America. So what we have happening in 1946 and 1947 is that we have murdered black people that then creates an impetus, a political impetus for this report. And then in the report, what needs to be preserved, what needs to be protected are not black lives per se, but what needs to be protected is a certain innocence of the American state, a certain way of cleansing the state of these little markers of racial prejudice. And what's so amazing to me about Myrdal and the way he's used in that report is that the report's only block quote from a scholar is actually from Myrdal. And that quote is the idea that we need to be afraid of racial discrimination because it actually engenders resentment in black people, and that this resentment can lead to acts of criminality. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that the core concern for why we need to remedy racial discrimination is that if it goes unremedied, black people are going to engage in criminality and insurrection. That logic is at the heart of the liberal civil rights fight.
Yeah, it's a form of crowd control. You do also make the point that that the left or liberal left and the right shared a sense that there was something pathological about black people. They differed in the nature of the pathology, but there was something pathological, and we need to in the liberal version, be fairer and more transparent and incorporate more black folks into the process of criminal justice. The right wing answer is just more crackdown, more prisons, more cops. But this notion that there is something pathological about black people seemed shared across the political spectrum.
Yes, this is a form of liberal racial profiling. And that profile was always in agreement with conservatives that the default suspect for the crime problem are black people. The only difference between conservative and liberal takes on the crime problem, they agreed that it was a black crime problem. The only place they disagreed is what's happening in the black mind that we have that problem. Liberals were much more likely to have a kind of pity or cowering paternalism. They were more likely to acknowledge that the damage of white supremacy would have an impact, and that impact might come out as criminality. But let's just face it, when a white person is walking down the street or a white taxi driver is considering picking someone up, if they look at a black person and presume it's a criminal, does it matter if that person's internal logic says, oh, I think that black person's a criminal because black people are just like that? Or if they say to themselves that that black person's a criminal because they've had such a hard life? It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter. And how black people are policed or treated and how they are criminalized in everyday life, the logic of the liberal racial profile is no better than the conservative racial profile.
And then if we move into the LBJ era, I should say I'm speaking with Naomi Murakawa, who is the author of The First Civil Right, How Liberals Built Prison America, just out from Oxford University Press. Okay, the LBJ era, of course, is remembered mostly as, aside from the Vietnam War, as a period of domestic social progress, civil rights legislation, social welfare legislation. But the Johnson years also contributed to the carceral state. How'd that happen?
The two biggest federal crime laws that have been enacted in the 20th century were enacted during periods of unified democratic control. And the first was Johnson's Safe Street Act in 1968, and the second was Clinton's Omnibus Crime Act in 1994. So to start with Johnson, like many liberals of the time, believed that policing was a good, and that it was a good that should be distributed to all people, and that it was the federal government's job to intervene to make sure that everyone got their policing in fair and equal proportion. Right? Liberals were also in a long-term struggle to help police to professionalize, and there were many proposals to have a transfer of federal funds to state and local police departments for the purposes of more training, more professionalization, more recruitment and retention of so-called minority police officers. And we see this sort of coming up through the 1961 U.S. Commission on Civil Rights report, which had huge recommendations that there should be criminal justice modernization with police professionalization at the heart of the recommendations. And you see a buildup for this kind of reform coming through the 1960s that really culminates with Johnson's signing of the Safe Streets Act. Now, the Safe Streets Act gave huge federal money to state law enforcement, and many of the liberals who voted for it did indeed say things like, black people need better policing, they need better police-community relationships. But the problem is, liberals could not write their own intentions into policy mandates. So what do we have? We have final legislation that's giving money to states instead of cities. The legislation prioritizes riot control and organized crime. So something that began with a proposal from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission saying we need fair, racially just policing actually became 1968 legislation that was a huge transfer of funds that states then used to buy helicopters, patrol cars, infrared cameras, riot gear. The LEAA, as it was authorized by President Johnson, financed Louisiana's purchase of a tank. Louisiana gave that tank to New Orleans police, who then used that tank to raid Black Panther headquarters in September of 1970.
Yeah, so this so-called militarization of the police is a 40-some-year-old, more than 40-year-old phenomenon.
Yes. And when we talk about militarization of the police, it's important to underscore that it's not just about the technologies. It's not just about the tools. It's also about a shared understanding that the role of the police is to monitor people who are thought of as our internal enemies.
Moving forward, Bill Clinton, certainly not a liberal in the sense that Johnson was, more of a neoliberal, and you know, certainly his DLC philosophy born out of a reaction against Great Society-ism. But nonetheless, I was shocked at some of your numbers on the severity of the laws that were passed during the Clinton years in the name of the Third Way. So we had what? The Effective Death Penalty Act, which is one of the most ghoulish names for a piece of law I can imagine.
Yes, that's right. Clinton oversaw tremendous expansion of federal powers for policing. In some ways, though, I will say in the spirit of Johnson, there was also aims to reform policing and to make it look softer, look nicer around the edges. So the cornerstone of Clinton's Omnibus 1994 Crime Act was, of course, the COPS program, Community-Oriented Policing, which Clinton and his advisors said throughout was a philosophy, not a program. And in calling it such, they could have these gestures to little key phrases like involving the community and having police represent the communities in which they serve. But because it was just a philosophy and not a program, all the legislation did, once again, was transfer huge federal money to states and locals, who then just used that to hire more police officers, who then, of course, performed policing by the norms of the day. And the norms of the day were not gently working with communities and listening to local leaders. The norms of the day were order maintenance policing, being on the ground, and arresting for everything. Right? And that's what community policing became as Clinton subsidized it.
Yeah, well, that was roughly the time of the genesis of the Bratton model of a very intense focus on, you know, small offenses and massive deployment of force against certain neighborhoods.
Yes.
So, I mean, what's thought of as, you know, Rudy Giuliani and the right wing was, in fact, bipartisan.
Yeah, it was absolutely bipartisan. And, you know, Clinton's top domestic policy advisors saw this idea of adding 100,000 new police as a very natural, organic connection to Clinton's overall vision of reinventing big government. So in a really sort of sharp, ugly example of what some have called carceral neoliberalism, Clinton planned to fund the addition of COPS and to fund state prison construction by swapping out money that was quote-unquote saved by cutting more than 250,000 federal employees from the payroll. And the idea was that government can do certain things well. It can do things like police and incarcerate quite well, but it can't do things like solve poverty. And so this was a remaking of big government that would still keep the scope of government big, and I would say far bigger and more coercive, but diminish that which the government is responsible for providing.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, like, Johnson at least had something like a social democratic agenda along with the repressive side, but Bill Clinton had, what, midnight basketball?
Yes, that's right. As many scholars have noted, Clinton not only turned his back on African Americans, Clinton made it a point, a spectacle, to discipline Black Americans, to show that this was a Democratic Party that knew how to be tough on crime and tough on African Americans. This is obvious in the way that he worked on the 1994 Crime Act, in which the Congressional Black Caucus was deeply opposed to the expansion of the death penalty. And Clinton turned his back on the Congressional Black Caucus and was willing to split with them, and indeed happy to split with them.
Let's now talk some about Ferguson. Many of the prescriptions in the wake of Ferguson, although the president himself has been remarkably distant from these things, it seems, but many of the proposals that people are talking about are an extension of the things you talk about in the book and you've been talking about in this interview, you know, better policing, more training, more professionalization, more integration of police forces. Have we learned nothing in the last 50 years?
We've learned too little. I think we've learned too little because when we think about prison America, we tend to blame conservatives. And so we've pieced together the history in a certain way. And this is a history that does not include the liberal reforms to hire more Black police officers, to have more monitoring, to have more training, to incorporate the community. And there's a real problem when we excise this history. And the problem is we don't understand that right now we have the same liberal proposals put forward with the same good intentions, and they're likely to reproduce the same monstrous outcomes. Those outcomes are going to be more policing, bigger policing, expanded state power, and predictably with the worst consequences for African Americans and people of color.
Now, of course, in Ferguson, you have a city that is two-thirds Black, that is policed by, a 95% white police force. Would it have any effect to change that?
I think that when we're looking at police reform, we need to look at the totality of policing. And the totality of policing is that there is simply too much that is criminalized. So the evidence on whether or not Black police would do a better job, for example, is quite mixed. I would say a preponderance of the evidence is coming down on the side that police are going to arrest at rates that are comparable with the kind of arrest rates that are happening within their departments in any given place. That is a message of we really shouldn't expect to see much change, right? The institution of policing works the way the institution of policing works. We can see what's happening in the news stories around Ferguson is that they tend to operate around this idea of figures or the individual police officer, perhaps one good cop, one bad cop. Right. And this is the way the story around Darren Wilson, white cop, versus the good cop who came in, Captain Ronald Johnson of Missouri Highway Patrol. Right. And the media story is sort of circling around these two individuals. The story of reform has nothing to do with individuals. Policing as an institution could not be made better by the idea that we can just keep selecting the same people and slot them into the same set of institutional power and expect different outcomes. What we tend to do is focus on who's making the arrests and the technicalities, the politeness by which officers are making arrests. And the fact is not about who's doing it or about the technicalities. The problem is the fact that so much is subject to arrest, that we tend to legislate almost all of our social problems by adding additional criminal laws. So every year, police make about 10 to 12 million arrests. Right? 10 to 12 million arrests. About 5% of those are for violent crimes. About, another 10 to 12% are for property crimes. And then the rest, the vast majority, are for essentially misdemeanor offenses, non-traffic misdemeanor offenses that flood state courts, so that of these millions of arrests, you get about 500,000 a year for public drunkenness, you get another 500,000 for something that's called disorderly conduct, another 200,000 for vandalism, more still for violating loitering and curfewing arrests. In other words, the problem of policing is the fact that we have criminalization as a mode of governance, and then we tell police officers that it's their job to go out and enforce these criminal codes that are just full of hundreds of statutes and that grounds on which you can arrest almost anyone. And I think what we need to seriously consider when we're thinking about criminalization is we need to not just look at police and feel comfortable looking at them and saying, those are bad people doing a bad job. What we need to do is widen the lens and ask ourselves why it is that we criminalize so many acts. What does it mean that we keep loitering and public disorder and civil gang injunctions on the books when these statutes are so overbroad and so vague that we couldn't reasonably tell anyone it's their job to go out and enforce them? So I suspect that what's happening is that you know, what a lot of people want is they want to go out and do their shopping downtown. And, you know, there may be a group of white teenagers sitting around with their shopping bags, sitting on the sidewalk, having a conversation. And perhaps next to them, there's, you know, a person in tattered clothes, maybe talking to himself or herself with his or her own shopping bags that may have everything they own in the world. And there is no criminal statute we could write that says, just arrest the undesirable one sitting on the sidewalk with the paper bags, right? We just have the general statute. And then we ask police to go out and make these decisions for us. And I think an honest grappling about criminalization and policing means that there's going to have to be a bigger conversation where we look at the criminal code and we ask ourselves why we think we have to have all of these things as subject to arrest.
Then to conclude on a very ambitious note, we're inserting police into a society, asking to keep order in a society that is profoundly polarized, getting more so all the time, geographically segregated, and a country with a history, incredible history of violence in general. These are really treated as, you know, legal and police problems, when in fact they're profound problems of the whole arrangement of the political economy.
Yes, arrangements of the political economy, arrangements that are woven into the history and present-day reality of white supremacy. And I would say that we need to exit from a standard of justice that is the liberal standard of justice, and that is a metric that asks us to evaluate criminal justice machinery by the procedural or administrative quality by which we arrest, warehouse, and put people to death. And instead of that, we need to move towards a metric of understanding how our criminal justice machinery produces and exacerbates group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. This is Ruth Wilson Gilmore's standard for how we should understand racism, which is racism as the state-sanctioned and extra-legal production and exploitation of group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. If that sounds like a long phrase, we could also just turn to the many young demonstrators and take seriously the value that Black life matters.
That was Naomi Murakawa, whose book, The First Civil Right, is just out from Oxford University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News.
Home of the brave, land of the free, I don't want to be mistreated by no bourgeoisie, Lord, in a bourgeois town. Bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues are gonna spread the news all around.
Some of the Bourgeois Blues by Lead Belly. Next, Amy Binder. She teaches sociology at the University of California, San Diego. She has a piece in the Washington Monthly reporting on her research into why so many graduates of Harvard and other elite universities go into finance and consulting. It's not a happy story. Amy Binder. It seems like lots of students, graduates of Harvard and other elite institutions are heading to Wall Street. Just give us some idea of the magnitude of that first.
In 2014, according to a Harvard Crimson survey, that's their newspaper on campus, 31% of graduating seniors went to exactly two sectors. One is financial services, particularly investment banking, and the other sector is consulting. So about a third of the class in 2014. Now, this is down somewhat from before the financial meltdown. So in 2007, nearly half of the class went into these two sectors, so 47%. So this is, you know, pretty extraordinary numbers coming out of these universities.
The idea that somebody fresh out of Harvard could consult with anyone on anything is kind of amazing to me, but I guess that's part of the arrogance of the institution.
Right. Or the arrogance of the, you know, of these kinds of firms in thinking that they can train these students to do these jobs very quickly.
And when we're talking about consulting, we're talking about McKinsey as the gold standard of that crowd, right?
Correct. So McKinsey, Bain, Boston Consulting are the top three.
Why are students doing this? First of all, let me ask, do they have any idea what they're getting into?
Well, they have a pretty good idea of what they're getting into because they can see so many of their classmates doing this. Interestingly, when they come into college, they have virtually no idea of what these jobs are. I mean, these are pretty esoteric industries, of course, but they see so many of their older classmates chasing after these jobs. And so by their sophomore year, they're really picking up on the fact that so many are going into these jobs as, you know, immediate destinations right after college. And the reasons why they're doing this are really multiple. I mean, first and foremost, I would not say that it's because administrators and faculty think that these are great jobs. They're not hearing this in the classroom or from their college presidents that these are the kinds of jobs that they should be doing. In fact, faculty and administrators encourage them to find their passions, do what they love, forego the temptations of these industries. But these students are really very careerist and they end up constructing these jobs as being the best jobs that they can possibly get out of college. And they think of them as very risk-averse jobs. These firms present themselves as the best thing that they can possibly do right after college. The firms advertise themselves as choosing only the best and the brightest. They're very competitive to get. And all of this really appeals to Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, Wharton students. They see this as kind of the next step after these elite universities in terms of, you know, what I can do to continue on in a prestigious track. And they also see these jobs as stepping stones to other jobs down the line. They don't particularly love what they'll have to be doing in these jobs, but they see them as what I would call career accelerators.
It's a stark contrast. I went to Yale in the 1970s, and it's a fairly stark contrast to what the Yale graduate was looking forward to in the 1970s, which was law school, medical school, graduate school in maybe one of the humanities or the arts, or being bohemian, running around for a few years till you found yourself. There, I can't think of more than a handful of people who even thought of finance, and most of us regarded that as a rather odd choice. So something happened over the last 30 or so years.
Right. Well, so that's interesting that you raise what it was like at Yale in the 1970s. I was a Stanford grad in 1986, and you know, my first job was a $9,000 a year job working at a dance company, and my next job was a $9,000 a year job working at a magazine as a fact checker. But I was noticing that there were a lot of people who were talking about management consulting. And so something did happen in the 1980s. And what happened was these firms had profited quite a bit in the preceding years. And they decided to come to elite campuses, only elite campuses, to find folks to fill these new positions that they had created specifically for undergraduates. So prior to the 80s, the way people got into Wall Street and into consulting was really through kind of old boy networks at the level of undergraduates or through MBAs. So things changed radically in the 1980s.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Stanford because Stanford, of course, is next to Silicon Valley. And wasn't there a pipeline into tech in those days?
Yeah, certainly. Stanford has a different, you know, a slightly different, what I call an organizational saga in terms of where students see themselves and how they see themselves. And Stanford still clearly sends a lot of people into high tech. And one of the things that we're finding in the research right now is that Harvard is scrambling very much to catch up with Stanford in terms of positioning their students for high tech jobs. But finance and consulting are very much the strongholds at Princeton, at Wharton, and at Harvard.
Of course, Harvard has MIT down the street or down the river, but there's not a big move from Harvard into tech.
Well, this is changing. So we were really concerned. When I say we, I'm talking about my research team, Dan Davis, who's a graduate student at UC San Diego, and Nick Bloom, who's a graduate student at Duke University. And we really started this project interested in the question, how is it that so many students go into finance and consulting? What is happening to them on campus such that they want to occupy perhaps upon their, occupy these positions right after college? But in talking with them just this past year, we really noticed that high tech was very much on the lips of Harvard students as well as Stanford students. But quite noticeably, the kind of high tech that they were talking about were the highly established firms, particularly in the social media sector. So people at Harvard now talk about Goldman Sachs, they talk about Bain, they talk about Boston Consulting, they talk about Google, they talk about Facebook, they talk about Twitter, they talk about LinkedIn. So this kind of new appeal of high tech, we might see that as a good thing, but they're also only looking in terms of what is prestigious at very highly established firms.
They don't want to be the next Mark Zuckerberg. They want to go work for Mark Zuckerberg.
Right. I mean, they wouldn't mind being the next Mark Zuckerberg either. I think they think that Stanford has a bit of a competitive advantage in that area. But what we're talking about is very high recognition, marquee name jobs. I mean, a lot of these students really want to get into jobs that advertise to the rest of the world and to themselves that they are uber successful. And the way that you do that is by getting a job at a place that everybody recognizes and which has this super competitive tournament system for getting these jobs. So by going through the competition, by landing a job that everybody knows about, you're kind of extending your identity as the creme de la creme, the best of the best, the best and the brightest. You know, one of the things that really emerged in doing the research, we had started by being very interested in the finance and consulting firms and why students were going toward those. But in the course of doing that research, we found that established social media firms in particular were very much on the horizons of students at Harvard and at Stanford, and that these students saw these jobs as kind of the equivalent in terms of bestowing prestige on them, like the finance and consulting firms.
Do you see any broader demographic reasons for this? Is there something about this generation? You hear contradictory things about this, the millennial generation. One is that they're extremely progressive. Pollsters saying the most progressive cohort in the history of polling I've seen. On the other hand, older people denouncing them as greedy and selfish and shallow and money-grubbing. Is there anything that you can see in the demographics that can explain this shift?
Yeah, it's such a great question. Number one, we talked with liberal students, we talked with conservative students, and this is not one of those phenomena that is divided into, you know, only the conservative students, only the students who are, you know, particularly interested in building great wealth. We see this across the board among these students. So our explanation really gravitates toward not thinking about these decisions as being individual level decisions. This isn't about students who are necessarily following their individual preferences for being in finance and consulting. This is really about how universities are places where these occupational aspirations emerge. And they're emerging for students from all backgrounds. These are students who've never heard about these sectors before. These are students who might be working class. Well, not that many people who go to these schools are working class, but, you know, not at the top of the affluence heap. So we're seeing this across the board among students. If 31% of the students at Harvard are going into these sectors, it means a whole lot of people are not going into these sectors. But the 31% is still this kind of extraordinary number.
I'm speaking with Amy Binder, a professor of sociology at UC San Diego. How does it happen? What are the institutional pathways that lead so many to the doorsteps of Goldman and McKinsey?
There are a couple of things that are happening. I would say, again, in response to your question about millennials, this is an ambitious generation, certainly among the folks who go to these schools, right? They've worked hard their entire lives just to be at these schools. And there's a lot of anxiety in these kids in terms of what they're going to do next. And there's a lot of kind of cultural pressure on them to be unique, to be special, to fulfill their promise, to do something exceptional. And they feel a lot of that peer pressure on campus, not only from their classmates, but also by dint of being at these incredible institutions. And so we see actually quite a bit of ambivalence among these students. So they want to do something special, but they also want to be recognized and be continued to be recognized as these incredibly talented people. So what happens on campus is there is both a lot of kind of cultural stuff that happens. There's a lot of talk about these careers. There's a lot of agonizing about these careers, but there's this thing called structured recruitment that occurs every year where these firms come on campus, they pay the career services center on each campus quite a bit of money to have access to these students. And over the years, they have just honed this to an incredibly well-oiled machine. So they come to campus, they send, the firms will send people from their companies who actually went to college at the college where they're recruiting. So there's a kind of relatability factor in terms of students seeing what they could look like X number of years later working at McKinsey. They do highly structured resume writing workshops. They hold very glossy, lovely receptions for these students. Resume drops, they have particular dates when all Harvard students will have their resumes clustered with everybody else from Harvard who's applying for these jobs. And then once the resumes are dropped and they looked at, these students then have on-campus interviews. The interviewers come back to campus and students are running around in their suits and they're going from interview to interview. And then after that set of activities ends, then there will be flyouts to New York or to other parts of the country. So it's just an incredibly coordinated effort. And the point here that I really want to make is that universities are participating in this a lot. So the campus is not just a place where a kind of happens. The university is taking money from these firms, a lot of it, and providing them with the best venues. They're providing them with direct access to students' email inboxes. They are coordinating these resume drops. So they're really complicit in this whole process. And then what happens is that these companies get a jump on every other possible employer. So they are able to make these very early offers to these students, which is also seen as just as a really good thing, positive thing to have a job offer early in your senior year.
It sounds like there's this dance of mutually inflating narcissism going on. Like you have the students who want to be associated with a fancy name like Harvard. You want Harvard wanting to be associated with a fancy name like Goldman. Goldman wanting to be associated with Harvard. Is this ego swelling at a very high level?
You know it. I mean, that's an absolutely gorgeous way of putting it. In fact, I'm going to ask you to repeat that phrase because I'm going to work it into my papers. But that's exactly what's happening. You know, the firms, one of the points that I make in a Washington Monthly article that I just wrote is that, you know, these firms, when they hire these students for these two-year analyst jobs, whether in consulting or in banking, you know, they're working these students to death or these graduates to death, and these graduates are doing research and they're writing up Excel spreadsheets. But this is not work that only Harvard and Princeton and Stanford students are needed to do. You know, you could get students from a whole bunch of of universities. You could get the top students from, you know, a range of universities, public, private, liberal arts, what have you. But the firms have really targeted these campuses because they want to have bragging rights about, you know, even the member lowest on the totem pole is a Harvard graduate, is a Wharton graduate, is a Princeton graduate. So there is this kind of mutually self-serving ego boosting on all sides. And if we look at it from the university's perspective, such structured recruitment ensures that a large number of students are going to have jobs when they graduate. And these are really well-paying jobs, right? And they're building alumni networks. And they think that these jobs also are going to accelerate students' careers into other highly remunerative positions. So it really does feed on itself. It helps everybody, except for students who don't particularly want to do this but fall into it. And it doesn't particularly help students who make a decision not to go into it, but who suffer anxiety about whether they've missed out on something important.
I presume this will be really good for the Harvard endowment in the long term, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I haven't done that kind of work yet. I'd like to look at who trustees are, see which firms they come from, but I haven't done that yet.
Now, is this good for America? I mean, we have all kinds of economic and social problems, and the allegedly best and brightest, who knows if they really are heading into things that have at best a neutral social contribution and perhaps at worst a destructive one. Is this something that we should be worried about beyond the precincts of the elite realm?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, yes. I wouldn't have done this project if I didn't. You know, I have some concerns about the financialization of the economy. And one of my prime reasons for doing this project was to see, you know, there's been a lot of work about how our economy has been increasingly financialized and what this means for workers and levels of inequality and so forth. So I do have an interest in those things. I think what students would say is that they're doing these things not for the long haul, but as stepping stones into something else. But there are a lot of people who suffer the phenomenon of having golden handcuffs, right? Once they start this, there are a lot of people who don't get out of it. And if you think about all of these students who might be going into what I would call more socially productive first careers, you know, we're really losing out.
Yeah, well, you know, they said there's a saying on Wall Street back in the 80s, if you think $1 million a year is a lot of money, you obviously don't have kids. And that was three decades ago. So, I mean, the standards of what is enough money have been ratcheted so high that, you know, it seems like people feel like if they're not making seven figures, they might as well be in the poorhouse.
Right. Well, and money is an interesting thing. We talked with students about money and the degree to which the salary and other kinds of perks pull them in. But they say that is of somewhat lesser concern to them. They feel like they are part of the world where things are really happening. They are, you know, learning a lot about the industries to which they are consulting or, you know, in which they're making recommendations for mergers and acquisitions. And so there's just a lot of other stuff that goes along with the money that is drawing them in. But it's true, you know, once you establish a lifestyle like this, it's not necessarily easy to get out of.
I have to say, a lot of this sounds almost like a clinical description of narcissistic personality disorder.
Can you say more?
Well, it's just that this sense of being at the summit of society, of being really, really important, the prestige of the institution, but with a hollowness about it, not a real dedication or a passion.
Well, you know, one of the things that we saw, and again, I'd like to push further in the research on this, is that students, you know, there's actually quite a bit of cognitive dissonance. There's this sense of, I made it to Harvard, I made it to Stanford. What does it mean when I'm no longer going there? You know, like there's this really big halo effect that comes from going to these schools and they're about to graduate. I mean, they can always talk about being graduates of Harvard and Stanford, but it's harder to continue thinking of yourself as being at the apex of the hierarchy, right? When you're no longer a member of that particular community. And I think so much of this is really extending that position in society. So you take the job that is most like Harvard and Stanford, and you can elongate your sense, your identity here. But, you know, that comes with some costs. I think that there's a lot of anxiety. I think that there's a lot of insecurity. So I suppose if I were to look at the DSM-4 or 5 or wherever we are in the diagnostics of narcissistic personality, you would see that there's a lot of insecurity that goes with narcissism. And that's probably true here too.
Yeah, well, actually, I think they've dropped narcissism from the DSM-5 or 6.
Have they?
Perhaps because it's become so universal. All right. Well, thanks a lot. That was Amy Binder, professor of sociology at the University of California, San Diego. Her article, Why Are Harvard Grads Still Flocking to Wall Street, is in the September-October issue of the Washington Monthly and is on the magazine's website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. The Go-Go's, live in Central Park in 2001, covering the Ramones' I Want to Be Sedated, because sometimes you just feel that way. Till next week, bye.